Morning. I want to show you something today. This is some of you will think this is really cool. Others of you will think this is dumb. This is Bob. Bob. It stands for bug out bag. When you just got to go, right? You just got to get out of town and something bad has happened and you just grab this and you keep it in the trunk, you know. And so what this is, I was never a Boy Scout, but I love their motto. Right? Be prepared. You know, my family has a version of it that we generally apply when we're talking about packing for a trip. It's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And so this has pretty much everything you could need, you know, just to kind of survive for a while. You know, super important, got to have your water, all right? You know, flashlight, you got to have a light. That's important. Let's see, what else? I'll put that there for a second. Just, you know, some gloves. You got to have, you know, protect your hands. Bug spray, never know. Let's see. Oh, yeah, this is important. A first aid kit, that matters. What else? Oh, I have some water, but, you know, sometimes you find stuff. So this is one of those life straws that you can, like, suck out of a stream and it'll purify it and, you know, you won't get sick and all sorts of stuff. What else? Oh, yeah, this is good. I've got some fire starter, like fat wood here to start a fire. That'll get it going. Sometimes you need a little help to get that going, so I keep an old phone book in there. Also, you never know. I mean, some places don't have toilet paper. This is cool. This is a Special Forces survival guide, you know, so that can be helpful. You can find out all sorts of neat stuff there. Got some rope with some carabiners on it. Got some freeze-dried food. That's important. Got to have that stuff. What else? Let's see. Oh, another fire starter thing. That's cool. This is awesome. I don't know if this is like a big knife or a small machete or what. I just think it's awesome. That's just cool. You know, because you never know. And it's got like a saw on the backside and all sorts of things. That's pretty slick. I want to make sure it gets... There we go. Okay. What else do we have? Oh, yeah. Backup knife. You know, that matter. And then this is cool. This is a solar shower. Have you ever seen those end of the world movies? They're all dirty all the time. And I like being clean. So that goes in my survival bag. Let's see. What else? We got other stuff in here, too. Sporks. Multi-tool, you know, that matters. You gotta keep, you know, have your tools and stuff handy. What else do you need for the end of the world? Oh, yeah. That. But you need this. If you're gonna face the end of the world, you need that. And that's really the most important thing to have with you at the end of the world. If you've got your Bibles today, please open them to Matthew chapter 24. I want to thank you for being here with us at Chapel Rock this morning. If it's your first time here, my name's Casey. I'd love to meet you. When we're done, I'll be down front. Please come down and say hi. I'm dressed for the end of the world too, right? Got my, you know, technical, like tactical boots and moisture wicking clothes and a warm outer layer. Like, we're ready for this. So if the whole thing falls apart today, you picked a good day to show up to Chapel Rock for the very first time. I only have one machete, though. So, but if you're joining us online, thanks for logging in from wherever you are. We're grateful that you do that. If you're local, please come visit us. Take a second, fill out your online connection card. Let us know you're there. You can also give that way if you want to do that, too. But regardless, you take a second, fill out your stuff in here. A few things just before we get into this for housekeeping. Again, John mentioned it earlier. Let me remind you, we do need you in your bulletin to sign up if you plan on coming to the annual meeting. We would hate to run out of ice cream for everybody, so please let us know that you're planning on doing that. And just, again, sign that on the flap, leave it in the seat next to you. Our ushers will collect that later. That's 7 p.m. next Sunday, okay? Also, just got a note this morning that Edie Scoggins passed away early yesterday morning. So her memorial service will be next Saturday morning, November 3rd. The visitation's from 11 to 12:30, and the service is at 12:30. So I want to let you know about that. Please praying for her family. One update on the HVAC stuff. Some of you may have noticed it was warmer in here when you walked in. Some heads nodding. Yeah, a couple of our guys were in here working, moving around furniture, and they're like, you know, it's kind of warm in here. So that's good. We got two of the five units that we're going to buy, that we're going to get, are done and installed. They're working on more, and so they're in and working. And then also, if you would, just remember our Samaritan's Purse team down in Rockville, Texas. They're working to rebuild homes after Hurricane Harvey. So we got some folks from Chapel Rock down there. Please be praying for them. We are concluding our sermon series today called Go Ask Jesus. And so we've been looking over the last several weeks at the questions that people ask Jesus really in the latter half of Matthew's gospel. Today's question is this: when is the end of the world? And that's an appropriate question. I mean, when we have major world crises in short succession, like two massive and destructive hurricanes, you know, when another shooting in a synagogue out east this weekend, you know, this massive caravan of migrants coming from South America to North America, an election, you know, these crises, people start asking, is this the end of the world? For a while, 5 or 6 years ago, we had another round of disaster movies. It was real popular in the 70s, kind of went away for a while, and then they were back. You know, we had these disaster movies. We had The Day After Tomorrow, where the whole world freezes. We had San Andreas, where California cracks off and falls into the ocean. And then we had 2012. Remember that one? It was based on the idea that the Mayan calendar ended in December 21st, 2012. And people got, do you remember this? They got all freaked out about it. Like, oh, it's the end of the world, it's the end of the world. I'm not worried. They didn't see Cortez coming. I'm not worried about it. People get all worked up about the end of the world as if they could do something about it. You know what you can do about it? You can be ready. That's what you can do. You can be ready. And maybe you want to put together a bob. Probably that's, at the end of the day, a small measure. Now, some of you thought that was goofy. Some of you were like, oh, maybe we should do that. And others of you who are really into survival are looking at my stuff going, amateur. You know, here's what you don't know. All I need to do is survive long enough to get back to all my redneck buddies in Missouri. Because those rednecks know how to do this. Here's the deal. When a tornado leveled my hometown, just flattened a third of it, FEMA showed up a week later, and they were like, well, y'all are about done. Because these rednecks have their own bulldozer. I mean, it's amazing. So I just need to get there, you know. Here's the thing. We got to be ready. At the end of the world, you got to be ready. And that's what I want to tell you today. That's the big idea, all right? The only way to prepare for the last day of the world is be ready every day. The only way to prepare for the last day of the world is to be ready every day. That's what Jesus is telling his disciples right before he died on the cross. See, in our text for today, it's just a few days before the crucifixion. Jesus has spent the day in the temple teaching. He's being just peppered with questions from the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the teachers of the law. And every single time, Jesus answers every one of those questions in ways that completely dumbfound his opponents. They're just blown away by the acuity and the amazing power of his answers. And then in Matthew 22:46, it says this: no one dared to ask him any more questions. Now that's really significant. Because look at Matthew 24:1. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him and to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen? And what will the sign of your coming and of the end of the sign? What will be the sign of the end of your coming? Be the sign of your coming and the end of the age. I thought no one dared ask him any more questions. What's going on? Well, see, the questions he was asked before were not honest questions. As far as I know, nowhere in the Gospels does Jesus answer a dishonest question, because it's always a trap. They're always trying to trap him. Or at least he never does he answer it in the way that they ask it. He turns it around on them, or he asks them a question. But he often gives lengthy answers to honest questions. And this is an honest question from these guys. Jesus is on his way to Bethany. That's where he's staying, possibly in the home of Lazarus, Mary and Martha. And the path out of Jerusalem from the temple to Bethany goes right over the Mount of Olives. I mean, that's the quickest way to get there. And you know, they're going out of the temple complex, and the disciples remark on these impressive stones. Wow, look at this, Jesus. And they are impressive. It's hard not to be impressed. I want to show you a picture. I saw the stones, the walls these stones are built on. Okay, I took this picture in Israel back in 2016. You see that stone that's highlighted in red? That's one block of stone. It's about the size of a small school bus. I'm up and away from this thing, taking this picture. If memory serves, it's about 5.5 feet high, like the interior of a school bus. You know, maybe 6 feet deep and like 35 feet long. It's huge. They don't even know how much it weighs. And there's no mortar. It's just held in place with gravity. This was the base of the walls that the disciples were talking about. They're blown away by this. And Jesus says, all this is coming down. Now, this was the base. He wasn't talking about this. He was talking about the walls built on top of it. And they're not there anymore because Jesus said they were coming down. You need to understand, to a first century Jew, that's the end of the world. That the temple might be destroyed. That this great, powerful, amazing thing that had stood for a long, long, long time would be destroyed. That's the end of the world. And so their question is very logical. It's an honest question. When is the end of the world? How do we get ready for this, Jesus? How are we going to know when it's coming? And his response is, well, it's complex. So what I want to do today is just kind of walk through this passage. We're going to jiggle every doorknob and turn over every rock and help you understand some of the more difficult things that Jesus says here, and then talk about two ways to apply this passage, okay? First, let's continue reading the text. We're going to just do this in chunks because it's hard to swallow all at once, all right? Look at verse 4. Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains." Let's pause right there. See, in times like ours, people read that, and they go, okay, here we go. Everybody's at war. There's been two major earthquakes in 2 months, and most of California is on fire. We're at time, okay? And people get all worked up about this, and they miss Jesus' whole point. What Jesus is actually saying, I don't know about your Bible, but in mine, that's red. So what Jesus is actually saying here is that wars and famines and earthquakes and natural disasters, listen to me, those things are not the sign of the end of our world. Now, I realize that some of you may hold a different position on this. You may have been instructed differently, and what I'm going to say is going to really annoy you. Just, you know, there's probably a football game later today. You can think about that for a while. But Jesus says in verse 6, you're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars, but don't be alarmed. These things must happen, but the end is still to come. You understand what he's saying? The wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes, not the sign. Okay? Look, let's keep going. Verse 9. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Now, Jesus promises hardship, but understand, it is not the hardship of the end of our world, because Jesus' prophetic words were fulfilled in the lives of the apostles. Read Acts. Everything he told them that was going to happen, happened in Acts. Everything Jesus just said through that passage, it was the book of Acts. You just read it. Like, yep, okay. You can just go to it. It's like a punch list. All right, keep going. Verse 15. So when you see standing in the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Apparently, Jesus is saying, don't worry about Bob. Let no one in the field go back to get their cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you ahead of time. Okay, let's stop right there. I believe that everything described here was fulfilled by 70 AD when the Roman general Titus marched on Jerusalem. And here's the thing, the Christians of that day got out of the city. History tells us this. They heard Jesus' warning. When you see the abomination that causes desolation, a Roman general in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, that's what he means, pagan standing in the Holy of Holies. He's saying, when you see this, go, get out. Okay, and they did. Flavius Josephus was a Jew who lived and wrote in about 75 AD a book called The Wars of the Jews. In book 2, chapter 19, section 6 and 7, he tells about this Roman general, Cestius, who surrounded Jerusalem with his army. And then, for some inexplicable reason, Jesus, he backed off. The first church historian Eusebius tells us in his Ecclesiastical History, book 3, chapter 5, verse 3, that the Christians in Jerusalem did in fact get out of the city before the Romans destroyed it. And some of you right now are going, well, okay, Case, some of that makes sense. Yeah, but not everything in there fits 70 AD. I agree with you. Let's keep reading. Verse 26. So if anyone tells you, there he is out in the wilderness, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner rooms. Do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Just kind of a proverb of Jesus' day. He's not saying that like there's going to be vultures and carcasses at the resurrection. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Well, that sounds like the end of the world, doesn't it? It should, because that's what he's talking about. Now, hey, you say, wait a minute, just a minute ago you were saying it's 70 AD, and that... Let me see if I can try to bring some clarity. These are difficult verses. Okay, on the one hand, the language sounds apocalyptic, but there are also some very close linguistic parallels to the way that Peter speaks on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. The way that Peter uses Joel's prophecy on the day of Pentecost at the beginning of the church, I want to show you this side by side. Look at these verses together, all right? So here's the verse we just read in Matthew 24, 29. The sun will be darkened, the moon will not get its light, the stars will fall from the sky. This is Peter applying a prophecy from Joel to his Acts 2, that present day. I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and billows of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness, the moon to blood before the coming of the great and glorious day of the Lord. He's referring to that day, that he's applying that prophecy from the book of Joel to what for him was today. What do you see the parallel here in the language between the two? So is Jesus talking about his triumphant return in verse 30 and 31? Yeah, but in a different way than you might think. Because of that, it's tempting to think that this whole passage, all of Matthew 24 and 25, is about Jesus' second coming. But there are two pieces of information that I think prevent us from holding that view. The first is this. Let's look at verse 32 through 35. Look at this with me. Jesus says, "Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. Truly, I tell you, now pay very close attention here, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." Past tense, have happened. "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away." Whoa. Stop the eschatological train. Okay, hang on. This generation? Like the people he's talking to, like the 12. This generation. Did we miss it? Did the second coming happen? And we, like, I didn't hear the trumpet. What's going on? No, Jesus is referring to the people listening to him, that they would see these signs. But they were not the signs that the world was ending. They were the signs that the kingdom of God, the church, was coming. It was the end of the old sacrificial system and the beginning of God's new covenant with us, a covenant of grace through faith. See, this is not the first time that Jesus uses this phrase, this generation. Not in this context. It also appears in Matthew 23, verse 36. And I believe that that phrase, this generation, functions as kind of a bookend around these passages. All right? So I want to show you these side by side. Look at this. Here's Matthew 23, 36. This is near the end of Jesus' sermon on the woes on the Pharisees. Man, he is letting them have it. And he says, they're going to be guilty of the blood of all the prophets. And he says, truly I tell you, all this will come on this generation. And then a chapter later, he says, this generation will certainly not pass till these things have been accomplished. I believe what Jesus is doing is telling his disciples, here are bookends. This is the way that the Jewish mind functions. Here are bookends. This stuff applies to you today. The rest of it applies to the church in the future. Everything in those bookends applies to now, okay? But there are some exceptions to that. there have to be, because in verse 27 of Matthew 24 and verse 30 through 31, those are the exceptions. You're saying that because they sound apocalyptic. I'm saying that because Jesus changes the title he uses for himself. Did you catch this? All through chapter 24, he refers to himself as the Messiah. Except in those verses. In those verses, he refers to himself as the Son of Man. And I believe what Jesus is doing is he's jumping out of the current timeline for them and making a prophetic prediction of the future for us. Those are the exceptions because he changes his title, okay? He'd been using this title, Messiah. You see it in verse 5, verse 23, verse 24. In verse 27, he changes to Son of Man. He'll use it again in verse 30. And here's why that matters. In the remainder of Matthew 24 and 25, look at this. Jesus will use the term Son of Man and connect it to two other key ideas or words. He talks, whenever he uses this phrase again later, he talks about the angels or the day or hour of God's final judgment. You can see that in Matthew 24, 36 through 37, verse 39, verse 44, verse 25, 13, and 25, 31. He'll use that title, Son or Son of Man. He'll connect it to the angels or the day or hour of God's judgment. And so I believe that when he uses it earlier in 24, we're jumping out of the current timeline and we're looking at a future thing. And I believe that the disciples being trained in listening to Jesus talk for 3 years would have caught that. Every one of these things in verse 27 and verse 30 and 31 really do describe the final judgment because they match up with what happens later in that passage after the this generation bracket. So when Jesus says in Matthew 24, 14, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come, this is in between the this generation brackets. The end he's talking about is not the end of our world. It's the end of the temple because that was the answer to their question. Do you see all these stones? What brought it up was the temple. And so Jesus is saying, when you see all these signs, you'll know that's the end of that. That's ending to make way for God's kingdom to come through the church. Now let's read verse 36. About that day or hour, I'll come back to that in a little while. About that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. How great is Jesus' submission to the Father? He doesn't even know the hour of his own return. That's how much Jesus, God the Son, submitted to God the Father. He doesn't even know. He's willing to, so I don't know how that works. I don't understand it. But he doesn't know. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. By the way, the word in Latin when that's translated is rapto. It's where we get our word rapture. You don't want to be raptured. You don't want to be raptoed. That's what happened to the bad people. The good people were the ones in the ark. They didn't get raptoed. I know some of you, this is really moving your cheese. Okay, just go with me for a little bit, okay? He says, that's how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, rapto, and the other left. The women will be grinding in a handmill. One will be taken and the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and not let his house be broken into. So also you must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants of his household to give them their food at the proper time? It would be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. Truly, I tell you, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. Jesus is setting up the parables he's going to tell here in the next chapter. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time, and he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and in an hour he's not aware of, he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then Jesus goes on, and he's got several more parables that kind of reinforce his point. That's what we need to be getting ready for, verse 36 through 51. See, the thing is, we get so wound up in the fantastic versions of the end of the world that some have created around the return of Christ, we can get our priorities out of whack and do real serious damage to our relationships with the non-Christians around us. True story from Austin, Texas. Several years ago, the Austin paper ran this headline. Here it was, ready? Man experiences heart attack after the rapture. Here's the story. Herbert Washington, who worked at Significant Plastics, Inc., was just consumed with the rapture. Like, he just totally one of these biblical prophecy geeks, you know? I mean, just so into it, all right? And so he suffered a serious heart attack one day when his coworkers pretended that they'd been raptured without him. This is a true story. This really happened. One Tuesday, they lay work outfits on their chairs and hid in the supply room, and when he came back from the restroom, he thought the rapture had occurred. The janitor, you can't make this up, the janitor, who's an outspoken Muslim, pretended to have witnessed everyone disappear and ran around the office feigning panic. Herbert fell to the ground, clutching his heart and screaming, I knew you'd forget me, Jesus. What did I do wrong? This really happened. He was taken to a local hospital. The employees came out of the supply room pretty sober. One lady said, we didn't mean to scare him to death. He just was constantly talking about it and bugging us, so we decided to turn the tables on him. He underwent bypass surgery and is recovering well and, quote, digging into the Bible like never before, according to his wife. We can get so wound up in trying to nail down and predict all the specifics that we lose sight of keeping our heart ready. We get so wound up in trying to figure out the day that we're not ready for today. If you ignore everything else I said, get this. The point of Jesus' teaching here is not to give you a roadmap to the future. His point is that the only way to be ready for the last day is be ready every day. Now, that doesn't mean we're unconcerned about the end of the world. Again, like I said, I don't know if you noticed, but these are red words. Jesus said it. You need to care. Rather, it means we're so concerned about the way that this changes the way we live now. So there are two lessons for us in this passage. Here's the first one. Number one, we need to live carefully. We need to live carefully. Jesus tells his disciples, keep watch. That word means to consider carefully, to be concerned about something, to pay close attention to something. Well, what's that mean? How do we do that? I'll tell you, but first let me tell you a story. My roommate in college, Ken, was a really unique guy. He had a zest for life that was contagious. He had a laugh that could get the whole room going. Ken was just a great guy. He was a great roommate for me. You may not believe this, but I haven't always been this cool. Sorry. I went into college kind of in my shell, and my roommate helped me come out of my shell. And I'm thankful to Ken. Most of all, though, Ken had an intense drive to be like Jesus. See, he had this little plaque on his closet door, hanging on the closet. You know, it was one of those bifold doors on the knob that you pull on. It was not anything fancy. It was a piece of cardboard with some paper glued to it, cockeyed, and like two holes. I think he just jabbed an ink pen through the cardboard and stuck a string through. It was not fancy. And on this piece of paper, he had written just a few words, these words: "Today could be the day." And every morning when Ken would get dressed, he'd open up his closet, and you could see he'd pause, he'd look at that plaque, and as he's getting ready for his day, he's being reminded, today could be the day. Jesus can come back today. So live carefully. That's what he's saying here. Living carefully means a couple things. It means don't get weighed down by the addictions and concerns of this life. Listen, Jesus did not create you to live a life that's obligated to pursuing hollow, empty things. Now, this doesn't mean you can't have fun. He's just saying, travel light. Don't get weighed down by this stuff. The second thing it means is that we need to evaluate our lives. Our world moves so fast. I don't know if you've noticed or not. When was the last time you turned off the cell phone and grabbed your Bible or your prayer journal and locked yourself in a closet or went for a walk or, you know, just got alone with God and just slowed down? It's part of living carefully means carving out time in our schedule to reflect and respond, to reflect on Jesus and respond to the needs that you see around it. So you see, living carefully every day in such a way means living in a way that when Christ returns, it will not seem unexpected because you've been living this way for a while. You'll be ready because you've been doing what Jesus said to do in Matthew 25:36-36. Jesus says, "For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me." Jesus says, you fill up your time doing that and living carefully and you'll be ready. See, what Matthew is telling us here sounds a lot like what Paul says in Ephesians 5:15. Be very careful then how you live. Not as unwise, but as wise. Making the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. Did you catch that? Living carefully means maximizing every opportunity to display the love and wisdom of Christ. And the only way you're going to do that is to practice the second lesson in this text. And that's to prepare constantly. Live carefully and prepare constantly. See, there's a word that Jesus used in Matthew 24:36 that's really important. Most English translations, I don't think, do a good job transmitting the significance of it, except for the English Standard Version and the Holman Christian Standard Bible. The NIV translates the word about. Jesus says in verse 36, "But about that day or hour, no one knows." Now, here's why this matters. The English Standard Version, Holman Christian Standard have a better word. It's the word concerning. This matters because in ancient Greek discourse, this word was often used to denote the time frame of the discussion shifting. So I know this sounds really technical, and if you're not into this, just check out for a second. But in the ancient Greek language, they would use this word, this specific word, it's translated about here, a better translation is concerning, to denote the fact that the time frame of the discussion was changing. So what this was before, now we're talking about after. And that's what he says here, about, concerning that day. It's emphatic. That day. So we're changing time frames here. This is a different time zone. That's how we can know, I believe, that what was prior to that verse was for the first century, the disciples of Jesus' day. What comes after is for us. And this means that we need to be constantly preparing for it. There was a guy back in the 1800s named William Miller. It was actually in part kind of the founder of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. He predicted that Jesus would come and gathered a following of about 50 to 100,000 people. The end of the world was coming in 1843. And he had all these views about it. And so his followers pressured him to pick a date, and he finally did, and the day came. And, of course, Jesus didn't come back. And so he said, I got the math wrong. So he picked a different day, and his followers got all excited, and nothing happened. And he goes, "Oh, no, it's this one. It has to be this one." And so, you know, some people went to mountaintops, dressed in white robes, you know, get a head start when Jesus comes. Others were in the graveyard wanting to ascend to heaven with their dearly departed loved ones, you know. There are a few high society ladies who were kind of in the yard at a country house because they didn't want to ascend with the common rabble. But the day passed again fruitlessly. I don't get why people do this. They try to pick a date. I don't understand. I don't understand why people keep doing this. Why do they keep trying to pick a date? So far, the human race has a 100% failure rate. We've been wrong every time. I don't get it. You see, the word translated keep watch that Matthew used here emphasized being awake and ready for action. It's not a passive word. It implies that preparations are being made. So what preparations have you made for the return of Jesus? I'm not talking about putting together a bob. I'm not talking about signing up at aftertherapturepetcare.com, a real website. Pagans will take care of your pets after Jesus comes again. You can look at it. It's a thing. Don't pay money. It's a waste. See, Jesus can return today if the Father wills it. So what have you done to get ready? What are you doing to get ready? Like maybe telling a skeptical friend how your faith sustained you through hard times. Like paying off a debt. Don't use the return of Christ as a get out of jail free card. Like mending a broken relationship. I want to challenge you to do something to prepare this week. Don't waste your time with a bug out bag. Instead, make your own little today could be the day sign and hang it somewhere where you'll see it every day. Do something to prepare for Christ's return constantly. One of the ways that we do this is with something we do every Sunday. See, when Jews finish their Passover celebration, they lift their cup and they say, next year in Jerusalem. They express their desire to want to celebrate the Passover in Jerusalem. I want to ask our servers to go to the back at this time. We're going to prepare for our communion time. I heard about this church in Wisconsin. They have this unique communion tradition. In their church, they do it once a month. And on that particular Sunday, everyone holds up their cup and they say, next time with Jesus. See, in the chapter following this, Jesus will celebrate the Last Supper with his disciples. He'll say to them there that he will not partake of this meal again until he has it with them in the kingdom. So in just a minute, one of our elders, Andy Goodwin, is going to come and pray for our communion. And after he does that, the servers are going to come and pass it out. I'd like for you to hang on to both the bread and the juice, because we're going to take it together. Okay, the bread represents the body of Jesus that was tortured for our sins. The juice representing his shed blood that washes away our brokenness. You hold those things together. So Andy, you come pray, and then you hold the emblems and we'll partake together.
Lord, thank you for another day. It is a gift, and we receive it from you. And Lord, thank you for a new day with you in heaven. It is everything, and we are grateful for it. Lord, help us to remember that is why you came. In your name.